Very good. Today, I have had a bit of a breakthrough. It is March 21st, 2023. The time is 16:27 hours. Ward Green here. And my breakthrough today was I decided I was getting deficient in calcium, having avoided calcium and vitamin D for some days now, quite a few days. And I felt like I was getting weaker and weaker, even though I have been eating a variety of different food. Not sure which is right or whether they're both correct. I've been eating all kinds of things, okay, so, but I mean, not anything with calcium in significant amounts. And then I started to believe, well, probably I'm getting weaker because I'm not eating calcium. That's what I started to think. So I said, it's time. I'm going to try a matcha tea latte with cream and with, you know, full amount of dairy in it. And I did that. And I even took 1,000 units of vitamin D after that. And I haven't suffered any ill effect. In fact, I feel better. So I feel better than I did. No ill effect. Like, I was getting kind of, I don't know what the word is. What's the word? A weakness, but there's like a high frequency component to this. What do you call it? What was I going to call it? Confusion? Or what was it called? Delirium. Yeah, when you get, it's like there's some kind of a, but, you know, the effect that I had before when I felt I was toxic and I had taken too much vitamin D, when I'd eat calcium in the morning, particularly, I would get this feeling of, I think it was like the blood sugar went way up, that kind of feeling, you know, where you got this high frequency kind of vibration in your body. An unpleasant feeling of having too much blood sugar would be similar, whatever it was. It was similar to that idea. So maybe, but I haven't researched that. Everything that we need to learn, we have to research. So everything that we wish to learn about the human body takes an awful lot of research, much more than it would take to study the field of physics or any of the other material sciences. This is biology, and it's much more complex, as every vitamin and nutrient affects every other vitamin and nutrient in the body. They're all interconnected. And there's biology involved. There's not just nutrients. There's also many other things. Tissue and DNA and, you know, there are a lot of things going on in the body. A lot of things. So we can't explain really anything without a great deal of study. And I think, well, I'm at the time in my life where I've done a lot of research in various fields of study, such as physics and engineering and things to do with material science, things to do with the movement of bodies and the strength of materials and all sorts of things that I've studied in my life that, you know, have helped prepare me for this time when now I can begin to study the human body. But it's very, very gigantic endeavor. It's a gigantic task. So I'm not going to try to do it all in one day, certainly. So today I'm resuming calcium tentatively. But I also think that there's another very important thing for anyone who's suffering from what they think was vitamin D toxicity, or too much vitamin D, that if you really did take an awful lot of vitamin D, then you can stop taking vitamin D. But taking calcium is optional. So, I mean, this is what I want to say, what I've learned, what I read online, is that you might want to stop calcium. and possibly you want to stop calcium. I suppose it's possible you might want to keep taking vitamin D and stop the calcium is another possibility, but I don't think that's the primary or preferred choice. I think it's more obvious that if you've got vitamin D poisoning, you can't help but stop that. Obviously, you would stop your poison intake, which is in this case vitamin D. So all vitamin D would stop, but the calcium you might want to keep you might keep taking, because you still have vitamin D in your body, and the calcium you might not be finding that taking the calcium depends on many different factors, but it's optional. You might restrict the calcium also, and in my case I needed to because I'd get this reaction if I ate calcium. So even though I stopped the vitamin D, you know, I was still reacting to the calcium, apparently. But, I mean, you know, we don't know, right? Because I was taking so many other supplements. So I had to stop some of the other supplements also, like I stopped the boron or stopping the vitamin E, you know, and things. Just temporarily stopped some of these other vitamins. Selenium was a mineral I was taking. So I stopped that. But I found that in my research, glutathione seems to be good. So I was still taking an occasional, once a day maybe, which is only half the recommended amount, too, of glutathione. I was taking a very small amount of glutathione, which is a protein. But it was found to be beneficial in certain types of... I can't remember what specifically now, but it certainly didn't seem to have any harmful known effects. So I was still taking that. I'm not taking it right at the moment. Not today, and I'm not sure. I think I probably took it yesterday. But I mean, I'm trying to keep track of. I still take vitamin B12. It's essential. You know, vitamin B12. You can't stop taking that, I don't think, especially if you don't eat meat. But today I'm eating. Let me go over what I ate. Today I ate more nuts and peanut butter and honey and those berries. What were they called? Boysenberries? No. What are those berries called? I threw out the bag. Some people will know what they are. What are those berries called? My wife, she knew what they were called, so I never... She was the reason why I had them in the house. What's the name of the berries? Let's look up types of berries. Boysenberries? I don't think so. I should be able to find them. I have goji berries, but I haven't eaten any of them. Let's see. Salmonberry. It looks like a boysenberry, though, doesn't it? I think... It's not a boysenberry, I don't think. I need to know what it was. I need to know what it was. Here. Mulberries. They're mulberries. So I have mulberries. Let me write that down, because I'm going to forget. So I've been eating mulberries. I've had some beef jerky. I've eaten walnuts. I've had crackers. The Mary's crackers, mulberries, yeah, or mulberry berries, because the mulberry bush is one thing, and then there's the berries, so they're called mulberry berries. But okay, so I think I'm back on track. I'm not going to start large amounts of vitamin D for a while. Because there's a research source online where I found that in some cases, the vitamin D has a half-life. Now, a half-life, I've seen people represent it wrongly and say that half-life means that half of it leaves you in the time of the half-life, and the rest of it leaves during that time. So if it leaves in 15 days, if half of something leaves in 15 days, then the rest of it's gone in the next 15 days. That's not what a half-life means. Half-life means half of it is gone in 15 days, and then in another 15 days, a half of what's left is gone, which still leaves one quarter of what you originally had. And then in the next 15 days after that, half of that 25% is gone, and so you still have 12.5%. A half-life only reduces a thing by half. The quantity is reduced by half during the half-life. This is a biological half-life. We're talking about the half-life inside the body, how long it takes to leave the body. Vitamin D can leave the body, some forms of it, in 15 days, or some people think 25 days. They've measured it as 15 or 25 days, in the range of 15 to 25 days. That's one form of vitamin D. But there's another form of vitamin D in the body that leaves with a half-life of 82 days. That means it's almost 3 months. It takes for half of it to leave your body. So it's possible that even 1 year later, after having been intoxicated or, you know, after having been overdosed with vitamin D, 1 year later you could still have significant quantities of vitamin D in your body without eating anything that has vitamin D. So that's very important to notice, to realize. So I'll be waiting a year before I significantly start to really regularly take vitamin D again. There's another thing I learned, and that is 4,000 units per day is recommended for the average person who has normal amounts of vitamin D in their body. If you're not overdosed, you can, most people can take 4,000 units per day. However, that's just the average person who has a normal amount of vitamin D in their system. The people who are deficient in vitamin D can take much more than that. They can take much more than 4,000 without becoming toxic. So, without the vitamin D level being toxic. So, it's all about gauging it and learning about your body, it seems to me. You're not going to be, it's just, measuring anything, it just makes things more complicated. If you've ever built something, right, and you just said, well, I'm just going to build something, and you went and you got some wood and you cut the wood and you built it, you know, with the wood that you had, if you were just building without measuring anything, it's much easier, right? Now, as long as it's not a critical application, if you're just building a simple, very crude structure or very simple tool for yourself out of wood, or let's just say wood for this case, but could be building it out of any material. If you're just building a simple structure, then you may not even need to measure anything. If you don't have to measure anything when you're building something, it's much easier. It's far easier. Much, much, much easier. You don't have to think as much. There's no chance for a mistake because you're not measuring anything, right? I mean, it's when you measure things, that's when everything gets more complicated, because then you have to be concerned, well, did I measure correctly, as well as all the other problems? So measurement adds complexity. So to try to measure levels of things in your urine or in whatever other bodily fluids you might measure these levels in would be an added complexity in everything, because then you have uncertainties as to whether that measurement is meaningful with regard to what you're trying to learn. I mean, it's far more complex if you start to measure things. So this is why I really believe in a more, what's the word? I think it might be holistic. We're more holistic, you know. We believe in listening to our bodies, and I think that's a more holistic approach, because, you know, if you measure something, you're zeroing in on that thing. That's what we, if you say, this is what we want to measure, that's not holistic anymore. You're saying, I want to know what the level of this substance is in this particular fluid or whatever. You know, even if you're measuring, let's say you might want to measure the level of some vitamin in your food even or something. But that's not, that's far less holistic. I mean, because in order to be holistic, in measuring things, if you were to try to be holistic and you measured things, that would mean you have to measure everything, because holistic means everything, the whole. So you can't be holistic if you're measuring things. It's not possible, because you'd have to measure everything. And you can't measure everything. It's not possible. There's not enough time in the day. And it would complexify everything to where you wouldn't be able to understand anything anymore. And every measurement has an uncertainty, so the uncertainties would become infinite. So none of these so-called scientific methods, to do with measurement, are valid in a world in a philosophy that is holistic. But we listen to our body and we say, okay, let's see what we can learn. And I studied the iodine poisoning idea. I studied vitamin A poisoning idea. The symptoms that I had did relate somewhat to the iodine poisoning, because it looked like I sped up my metabolism and lost some weight. Could have been iodine poisoning as well. But I wrote down here that I didn't have... Well, my main symptom was I couldn't eat dairy in the morning. It seemed to be that seemed to be my main symptom. It made me feel unwell, shaky or something, or weak, and sort of like a little bit. I would compare it to the symptoms of the flu, but there were no real there were no real symptoms of flu. It was just some of the general weakness that you have with flu, those sort of feelings that you get when you have flu without having flu, because I didn't have any of the other symptoms of flu. I didn't have, I'm not even sure what flu is now, because I haven't had flu for a very long time, because I take vitamin C to wipe out the flu symptoms completely, or to wipe out the infection, not the symptoms. We can't wipe out symptoms. We have to wipe out infections, or we have to wipe out the origin, the root cause. We have to get to the root cause I believe we have to use food to get to the root cause, and not anything that's not a food. It has to be food. Now, frequent urination was the other symptom I had, and that could not be explained by iodine. Iodine poisoning would stop the urination, so I was having the opposite. So that suggested that I had, too much calcium in my blood, which is caused by possibly too much vitamin D in my body. And I had drowsiness, I had weakness, I had constipation. Okay, I'm trying to remember. I think drowsiness was another symptom of hypercalcemia, but it might have been a symptom of vitamin A actually poisoning. I could have had all three, vitamin D, vitamin A, easily could have had all three poisonings and iodine, so but in relatively minor amounts of poison, just relatively minor excess of these three, but not so much minor, but it was the very early stages of the toxicity that I was experiencing, it would seem. So now I feel I do feel a lot better, and that's just because of one bowl of latte. I think that's made a difference, but it's always too early. There are too many things happening. That's why it's one day at a time, and I will slowly get, eventually, maybe in a year's time, I'll start taking vitamin D again, maybe. But I'll notice, because there are symptoms of vitamin D deficiency. When you have vitamin D deficiency, then you can realize that it's time to start taking vitamin D again. So everything has a symptom. A deficiency has symptoms, toxicity has symptoms, and it's not going to be that hard to figure out what you need to eat. But another part of it is we learn by revelation. You know, we get these, you know, I mean, why would I think about, well, today's the day I should eat calcium? That's just not random. So it's not just some part of me. I'm not wise enough, even if I'm listening to my body. Well, my body could know, well, I'm deficient in something, but my body wouldn't know necessarily which food I need to eat. But that's why, I mean, there's not only, we have an option to believe different things. We can believe that all of our wisdom comes from within us, which doesn't make a lot of sense if we try that and we fall flat on our face because we fail. When we put faith in ourselves alone, or we can believe, well, some of our wisdom comes from outside of us through revelation. So Jehovah reveals to us from outside of us. He lets us know somehow. We pick up some signal, a message coming from outside of ourselves. And I'm not saying revelation is like a beam of light that blinds us necessarily in every case. It could just be a tiny little thing we pick up on somehow. And it's not necessarily from inside ourselves. That's what I think. Revelation can come from outside. From Jehovah, though, I'm thinking. That's what I believe. That's what I do believe. So we get revelation on what to do from Jehovah, and then we also listen to our body and say, well, I'll try that and see if it works. And then we listen to our body and see if it works. And if we do that, then we start to have faith in Jehovah and say, well, Jehovah knew I needed that because I tried it and it worked. So it is possible. So, okay, so I'm going to be starting a different topic of discussion here, I think. I want to talk about what I've been doing for the past few days. I've been studying, first of all, my watch. My old watch, it broke. It stopped working. It was a $70 watch, roughly a $65 watch, that I bought about 50 years ago. I'm guessing it was about 50 years ago, something like that. And it's very close to 50 years ago, I think. And it was a Waltham 17-jewel chronograph, wind-up, a winding mechanism. And the winding mechanism doesn't work anymore, so I think the mainspring is gone. Now, whether I could have that serviced I doubt that I could have it serviced for a reasonable amount of money. It would probably be, I'm thinking it would probably be better to buy a new watch. So I've been researching watches, and I found out there are watches I can buy online, all sorts of kinds of watches. So I haven't researched quartz watches because I didn't really think that I don't want to buy a watch that has to have a battery replaced. I've already got one of those. This watch has a battery. It needs replacing every 5 or 10 years, whatever. It's a Casio, you know, it's a very inexpensive watch, but it has a lot of interesting, useful things in it, you know, dual time and stopwatch, alarm, you know, it's got all these things built into it. It's only a $50 watch, but I want to buy a wind-up watch. So then I started investigating automatic watches. Oh, I've been researching night and day, every day I've been researching, and I've learned about dozens of different types of watches and maybe dozens of brands even. I've seen all kinds of brands. And, of course, the one I haven't researched much is the one that's just hard to obtain, and that's Rolex. It's so hard to buy a Rolex. So, I mean, I could buy one somehow, for sure. There are ways to buy them. But they're not inexpensive. They're the most expensive kind of or up there. You know, actually, they're not the most expensive. That's not even true. Actually, Rolex are probably the more expensive of the economy brand, you know, of the affordable. Rolex is a very good brand. So if I were going to buy a watch, the first thing I think of is Rolex. But then when I shop, I think, no, I'm never going to buy a Rolex because I'm paying for the name. I don't want to have to pay for the name of Rolex. And what the other problem is with Rolex, well, with any of these really name brands, you know, really good quality Swiss watches, Well, I've learned so much, but I still can't explain all there is to say about it. There's so much to say, and I don't know much. But you have to maintain these watches. If you pay $10,000, there's a Zenit, or Zenith. It's spelled like Zenith. It's pronounced Zenit, a Swiss manufacturer that used to make mechanisms that Rolex used in their watches until Rolex started to produce their own in-house. What do you call those things? I can't even remember what they're called. Their own calibers, anyway. Their own internal. There's a word. It's not called mechanism, but that's anyway. That's maybe it is, but it is a mechanism inside. It's either a self-winding mechanism, or you know, there aren't many of these. There aren't many watches that are manual wind, where you have to wind them up by hand. That's what I want. I realize more and more that's what I want to find, is a watch you can wind by hand. But when I was looking for that, I found a watch that I could buy for $100, $200, $150, and I could buy a watch that automatic, it has auto. It's automatic. I mean, it has auto wind. It's called automatic. They wind themselves just through the movement of your wrist. And of course, I've known about those for many, many, many years. It's just that this technology advances over time slowly, and more brands have been coming to market. And now you can get an automatically winding watch for, well, I'm certain you could probably buy one for a similar price many years ago, but back then money was worth more too. You know, because of inflation. I remember my uncle had a self-winding watch, if I'm recalling correctly. So I've known about these things a long time ago. My uncle Don actually would be the person who had the self-winding watch. But automatic winding is one type of mechanism. But then you have to think about, well, do I want that on my wrist? It's a big, heavy thing. When you move your wrist, you can feel that winding mechanism clunking back and forth, too. You might get used to it, of course, but do you want that? Or do you, you know, if, on the other hand, I could, that costs, like, that might cost, well, in the case of the one I found, it was a copy of a Rolex. They copied the Rolex look and everything, and it was only $100 and some to buy this watch. But if you bought a Rolex, it would be, you know, $10,000 and more minimum to get a Rolex. And then you look at the Zenit watches are in the $10,000 range. There's a lot of watches in the $2,000 to $3,000 range that are quite impressive, and they're also automatic winding. And then you can get solar watches, and I don't know whether they keep working if you have no sunlight at all. Like if I live indoors most of the time, can I get a solar watch, or is that going to eventually fail on me because I didn't go out in the sun enough? I don't know the answer to a lot of these questions. But then there's quartz watches that use a battery, and the solar watches also use batteries. They're just rechargeables, right? And then the solar watches also use a quartz for their timekeeping, which is more accurate in many respects than it's more accurate because it has more vibrations per second than a balance wheel mechanical watch. See, the balance wheel goes back and forth in a mechanical watch, and the quartz crystal vibrates at a certain frequency in a quartz crystal watch. But the quartz crystal watch, it needs electricity, so it's either got to be battery or solar powered. Whereas the mechanical watch, you can just use a mainspring, and it could be wound by an automatic self-winding mechanism, which is wound by your wrist moving around, or it can be manually wound by your turning the crown. And so there are many different kinds of watches. And then there are watches that have chronographs, which are stopwatches built into them. And there are watches that have dates and moon phase built into them, where they keep track of the phase of the moon and or the date and the day of the week and things like that. And they will give you what day of the month it is. But, you know, every February you might have to wind them past the last few days in February or something, or, you know, past the last few numbers to get to the first of the next month. I'm not sure. It depends on, you know, some watches have perpetual calendars built into them so that the date adjusts itself automatically. But they're only good generally until the year 2100, because 2100 is not a leap year in the Gregorian calendar. So that's going to be an issue where is going to be a one-day adjustment needed in the year 2100, which may not. I don't think many people need to be too concerned about that, but that's still a one-day adjustment in the year 2100 is not going to be, you know, too serious of a problem to have to cope with. For one thing, since it's still a few years away, but also, it's easy enough to adjust a watch one day, you know, in a calendar watch. So, but the complexity of these watches is, even in the lower price ranges, I think they're becoming very sophisticated and complex. I'm not even sure that the lower price watches are going to be even inferior in accuracy either. Like from some of the reviews I've seen. Well, for one thing, mechanical watches just aren't as precise. So if you're buying a mechanical watch compared to a quartz, you're going to be having to reset the time perhaps every week or in some cases every day you might have to adjust it. But if you can tolerate losing a few seconds, I mean, it depends. Some of these watches might lose as much as a minute in a day. Which is probably, or gain a minute in a day, which would require you to reset them quite frequently. So it just depends on the particular watch that you get. There are so many factors, I think, involved in the manufacturing of these things. But quartz watches are known to be, or are supposed to be, much more accurate in that regard. And they're much less expensive too. Let's just say that quartz watches are under $1,000 or under $500 typically, but you can pay more, of course, for a quartz watch. Then there are watches that are based on atomic clock synchronization, where they can make a connection to a satellite and correct their own time based on, because they're electronic, they can correct their time based on an external source, a timekeeping source, and they can maintain accurate time by synchronization with those external sources. There are so many, and there are many, many digital watches that have. Casio makes one, for example, that's got a particular app that you can get, and you can run the app to do many different things with the watch using the app. To reset the watch in various ways, many different ways for different time zones and many other things, using the app. But that's an electronic watch, and it's far different from some of these mechanical watches. So there's a whole other class of watch, which is more of an electronic watch, which is getting more closer. It's getting in. It's more in the vein of the Apple Watch, for example, and all these other brands that have come out to try to compete with the Apple Watch, that's a watch. See, the Apple Watch needs to be recharged every day, whereas some of these other watches might be solar watches. They're electronic, but they're charged by the sun. The Apple Watch needs to be recharged very frequently, so it's a different class again. So there are many different kinds of watches available nowadays. Many, 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 many. So to really do a proper assessment, I'm going to have to consider, I'll have to consider the Apple Watch as well. Though I'm not very interested in it because I want a watch that's not dependent on anything to do with electrical energy. That's what I want. I want a mechanical watch as my second watch, as my secondary watch. So I've been shopping for mechanical watches and trying to find something to replace my old mechanical watch, which I've been using recently, which was a Waltham 17 Jewel chronograph. Then the chronograph on that watch broke many, many years ago, something like probably more than 40 years ago. that chronograph stopped working because the buttons fell off it, for one thing. And the number of chronograph watches you can get is astounding. The number of different kinds of chronographs, in terms of the way they're manufactured, but also how they work. Some of them have a reset button. Other ones, you don't have a reset button. You press the one button to start, stop, and reset. And these are watches that I'm looking at in the range of $2,000 to $4,000, or $1,000 to $4,000, let's say. About $1,000 to $4,000 range, which I could order one today on Amazon, probably receive it in some cases in a few days, but probably pretty soon I could receive one if I ordered one. But why would I want to pay thousands of dollars for a watch, right? See, the difference is when you buy a $4,000 watch, you're not going to just throw it away if it breaks, probably. I mean, it's not very responsible to throw it away if it breaks. So then you're involved in maintaining it, which means it needs service every 5 years. So why not? I mean, that's possible, but why not also consider buying a watch that's $100 and you're going to throw it away after 10 years or however long it lasts, and get another one, get a new one again. So I think, I don't know, I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. But the other danger of buying an expensive watch is they can be damaged too, you know, and by your own misuse of them, or they have screw down crowns, some of them, and you can strip the threads on the screw down crown. You know, there's so many different factors. It's almost easily overwhelming if you allow it to be. And they're beautiful pieces. They're beautiful pieces of equipment or technology that's been developed by watchmakers, right, over decades and decades. In some cases, getting close to centuries now. You know, for more than 100 years, they've been developing these mechanisms in Switzerland, as far as the mechanical watches. And I love that aspect of them, but then they require maintenance by a really qualified watchmaker. And that service costs hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars to service these watches. So if I bought a $10,000 watch, it would be worth spending a few thousand to service it every 5 or 10 years, right? But if I bought a $2,000 watch, how much is it worth spending to service that? And if I buy, you know, a $1,000 watch, or you know, obviously if I buy a $100 watch, it's not going to be worth much to service. I mean, it's not going to be. How much is it worth spending to service it? It's probably not worth much to service, because it can be replaced for another hundred and some dollars. So it's just a replaceable thing. Now, the replaceable option is, in some ways, good. I mean, on the other hand, these watches, I mean, it's cheaper too. It requires less investment, but it's also more of a throwaway consumer type mentality too. Whereas on the other hand, buying a very expensive watch, it could last generations and generations. It could last for centuries. You know, the watch itself, if it's maintained. But that requires a commitment on the part of whoever owns the watch. But, you know, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that that I'm going to be researching watches forever. I'm just, or as a pastime, or as a full-time job. I'm just saying, because I'm in the market to buy one, I have an obligation to myself and to everybody with whom I'm in contact to educate myself on what watches are doing these days. And I haven't even touched on one-tenth of the name brands, you know, for which I've been, or the names of which I've been exposed to in my shopping and about which I know a few things. And then these movements, that's what they're called. They're called movements, right? The movements that run these watches, they could be quartz movements, they could be mechanical movements or, you know, automatic movements, as they're called, if they're mechanical and self-winding. There's so much to learn, but, you know, I mean, I want to replace the watch I had, that's all. I just want to replace the watch I had. And I'm not sure that replacing it with a watch that costs $65, like I paid back then, is going to be a good replacement. However, it actually might be a much better watch than what I bought 50 years ago. For the same price, I might get something far, far superior to what I had. It's very plausible. But I don't know if I want to replace the chronograph function either, because I don't use it right now. So I was tempted because I was tempted to try to restore or replace the original watch that I bought, which had a chronograph function. So the problem is, well, if you're buying a chronograph, you have a lot fewer options, which is, that's a good thing, but they're a lot more expensive. And generally anyway, but there are inexpensive chronographs if they use a quartz movement. The quartz movements are much cheaper than the mechanical movements that are chronographs generally, although you can buy inexpensive chronographs. That's another thing, you can get mechanical watches that require you to wind them. There's one made in China, for example, and it's not self-winding, but it's got a chronograph built into it as well. And so that's an option. It's only a few hundred dollars compared to thousands and thousands for some of these others. There's just so many options, so many selections, so many choices, that it's not overwhelming, but it's not overwhelming if you don't let it become overwhelming. If you zero in on focus on, you know, zero in on what you're trying to do on one specific type of watch, like I've been zeroing in on the chronograph types, that helps me to do research without being overwhelmed. And then in the end, I might end up buying a watch that is just a normal watch that has no chronograph. But I've learned a lot about watches by narrowing my focus initially to chronographs, so that I won't be overwhelmed by the amount of information available on these other normal watches, whether they're automatic or quartz, or there's just so many of them. If they don't have a chronograph function, there are just thousands, millions probably, of these different models. The selection is so vast, so wide. Yeah, it's so extensive. I haven't even looked into the options in the mainstream. With regards to a simple watch, I have not looked at the options because there's just too many. I've only looked at the specific self-winding chronograph mechanical type watches initially, and I'm not interested in quartz. But maybe I am. If it's a solar watch, then I might be interested in quartz. But how can I learn? Who can teach me? You know what I mean? Nobody can really teach me whether the watch that I use in my house indoors will charge rapidly enough that I won't need to replace the battery every so many years. I mean, these solar watches have a secondary battery, and they have a rechargeable battery in them. And you can deplete the battery if you don't use them, I guess, or if they're not exposed to enough light, that is. But I don't understand how anybody can learn any of these things. I think technology is dependent on human interaction. We can't learn unless we talk to somebody who knows. That's the way technology is. I mean, I can research it, but I mean, so I'm, in a sense, I'm talking to them because I'm watching their videos, and then I watch some more videos, and then I, you know, it's an interaction. But I need to actually, yeah, at some point I need to get an answer from somebody as to whether I can do it or not do it. And I'm used to doing everything by research. It can be obtained by research. I can learn all these things by research, but if there's no interaction where I ask somebody, it's going to just take longer, take more research. I have to find enough examples where I can find somebody who's doing the same type of thing that I'm doing and having success with the watch they're using. Then I can be confident that it works. So we've used 45 minutes to talk about this, the health and the watches together. I want to replace my watch. So it's really an exciting thing. Oh, you know, actually, the whole process, it's opened up a lot of research possibilities, but it's all to do with timekeeping. It's not to do with any other technologies. It might have some overlap with other types of technology, I suppose. It will, because there are other aspects of technology, like electronics, that are involved, or mechanical. Mechanical engineering is involved in the movements and in the lubrication and in the mechanisms, the springs, and all the different things that work in the mechanical watches. There are a lot of things that can be learned from it, so it's opened up a lot of possibilities which are exciting to me for research and learning new things. But it's all with the purpose of trying to replace a watch and to find the right watch that I'm going to be committed to saying I'm going to own this watch, and you know, and I'll either maintain it or I'll replace it when it's worn out. I have to figure out what watch I'm going to buy, if I'm going to buy one, and I feel like I will buy one, but on the other hand, I actually have two of these watches, one of which is somewhat more worn out than this one, so I actually still have two watches. I'm not stuck in that sense, but I want to get another mechanical watch. I want to get it and to replace the one I had many years ago, and that whole prospect is so exciting. I can buy a watch for $10. I mean, it seems like, or I can pay $10,000, or I can pay... You could buy a watch for... I've seen watches that were over $100,000 already online. Like, I mean, that I could buy that were... You know, I mean, you could pay more than that. There's no limit to what you can pay for a watch, it seems. They can cost more than your house, or they can be, you know... There can be no more than the cost of a ballpoint pen or something. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable how much variety there is and how much choice there is. So today's study in the Wild Road article is, I think, a very interesting thing or topic. It's paragraph 4 and 8. We skipped over paragraphs 4, 5, and 4, 6, but they're also interesting. Hopefully we'll return to them at some point, but this is very interesting in continuing our study today, what we see here in paragraph 4 and 8, because it relates to the timeline again, the chronology, which we're trying to see with regard to the importance of knowing the chronology of the Bible. It's very important because if it can be established that we do indeed know the chronology of the Bible based on everything, scientific evidence, archaeology, astronomy, all the sciences can be brought to bear, and they all agree with this chronology that we've established using all of these methods in conjunction with the scriptures, then we indeed do have a discovery, right, that's very worthwhile, which is a support of the Christian religion, but also of the truth in general, that's always been the very inspiration and the very purpose of the writing of God's word was in order to record the truth. It's been the purpose to have the truth. The reason why God's word was written was in order to have the truth written down, to document the truth. So if we can substantiate, that's what it is, if we can substantiate the truth in the evidence of chronology, then that is a thing that's, for one thing, it's never been done before until these articles were written. It's never been done at all in any similar way, any comparable way whatsoever to the way it's being done here in terms of the level of confirmation that it's being established here. And so, what else can we say? It's never been done before at this level of confirmation. And it can feed back on itself in a good way. There can be positive strengthening come about because of knowing the true chronology. It then becomes the way, the means by which we do research. If we know what dates corresponded to what events, then we can do research in a more effective manner. We can know where to look in the chronology in time, right? We can know where we expect things to have happened in the course of time. And that can enable us to do research more effectively when we're researching ancient history, because we'll know if we're in the right time period or not based on the stratigraphy, for example, as we saw in a previous paragraph. It becomes very important, but it becomes... So it's not only the first time it's ever been done. What else can we say about it? It's the first time it's ever been done. But it's also... an incredible, unbelievably exciting new... It's powerful. It has great power in our lives. The truth does. It has power in our lives. So for the chronology to be newly established in a way that's more accurate than ever before, means that the chronology itself might be new, but it can bring a newness of life to everyone who studies it and understands it too. But it's not only the first of its kind. It's opening up new avenues for study. That's the other thing. I mean, we talked about 1923, right, being the year that Joseph was put in charge of all of Egypt as the second in command of Egypt in 1923 BCE. But we didn't mention the mirror date. The mirror date to that is 1923 CE of the Common Era. And in 1923 CE, something new happened in Egypt. Again, in the modern day, in 1923, there was a mirror event to the event of Joseph being appointed in 1923 BCE. So the mirror works in so many different ways. But this important mirror event, I don't even know what article it was in now. I haven't had time to research that particular thing, but I thought of it yesterday. This is another thing I've forgotten about. I'm now getting, okay, too nervous to type. Okay, here we go. The Constitution, I think, of Egypt. Something happened with the Constitution of Egypt. Let's see what we got. Yeah. Right. Well, in the article Preservation and also in Joseph and Own. Apparently. So in Joseph and Own, the article that we looked at also yesterday, it's called Joseph and Own, the Joseph and Owen, Redemption of the Phoenix. If we look up 1923 in this article, in April 19th, on April 19th, 1923 CE, the Constitution of Egypt was first promulgated by King Fouad I of Egypt. So the Constitution of Egypt was brought into being in the year 1923 of the Common Era for the first time. That's a huge historical event that's reflected in the mirror of the BCE date, 1923, when Joseph became ruler of Egypt. So I mean, there's so many correspondences in the genealogy of ancient dates with modern dates in the mirror of the Common Era. It goes on and on and on. The number of exciting things that can be derived from the chronology that we call the genealogy. And that's why I called it the blessed genealogy, because it had so many blessings that kept coming and coming. So let's read paragraph 4 and 8. Whether Semites lived in Egypt. I think I want to take a bathroom break first, I think, before I start here, but we don't have a lot of time to finish the study now, but we'll be all right. I just want to take a very brief break. We're right back. Rather than editing out, let's be right back. We've already talked about so many things. We've talked about so many things. We don't even have to do. It wouldn't even matter if we did our study today or not, because we've talked about so many things already. It wouldn't matter. It wouldn't be the end of anything, you know, closely resembling the world or anything. It would not constitute a very serious thing if we didn't do our study. But we need to do our study, right? As an ongoing thing, we need to be studying all the time. Something. We need to study something. But the most important thing is the Bible, but also this article is very important. Our study of these articles will benefit us very much in our understanding of the true chronology, which is a basis for faith in the historicity. Without true chronology, there's no history. So the fact that it's the first time that this history has ever been discovered is important, because it means that it's the first time the truth has ever been put down in a way that constitutes history. It's extremely important, because it's not been done before, but the fact that it has been done is a totally not only new idea, but it's a powerful idea. Not just new. It's the power of it. It's what it can do to empower us in our lives. And by the way, I think I'm learning that calcium is essential in human health. As I've just learned today, my health has increased by taking calcium for the first time in many days here. I'll find out how many days at some point. It's been a few days since I've actually consumed calcium, and I seem to be dying without it. But, I mean, we know that calcium leaves the human body whenever we eat protein and whenever we eat sugar, whenever we eat or consume, whenever we consume protein or sugar as food, we lose calcium. And we know that, right? We excrete calcium through the urine. The bladder goes out. The kidneys remove the calcium and it goes out of our bodies. And so our bones disintegrate if we don't take calcium. As we get older, our bones disintegrate without calcium. So we know we need that. But if we take calcium and vitamin D and we don't take the calcium regulating vitamin, which is vitamin K2, vitamin K2, if we don't take that, then we also die by taking calcium and vitamin D without K2. We need vitamin K2 as well as calcium and vitamin D. Okay, let's continue. Whether Semites lived in Egypt prior to Joseph and his family's arrival there or not, there is not benefit in departing from the biblical narrative in such matters, though Mr. Kurinsky would defer to much later experts. While Abraham had certainly predated Joseph, who was a fourth generation descendant of Abraham's, noting once more the reference to fourth generation, who perhaps fulfilled in part the prophecy by returning to Jacob from Egypt wagons to assist his removal there during a 7-year famine that occurred during his generation, the elder patriarch had himself visited Egypt earlier, meaning Abraham. Semitic immigration from Asia was noted by Breasted, and Mr. Kurinsky here heeds a late great Egyptologist, Sir Flinders Petrie, whose status in Egyptology is on a par with that of the great Breasted, was similarly impressed by the extent of Semitic influence he found on his excavations in Egypt. He was convinced of the fundamental Semitic origin of Egyptian civilization. That was Flinders Petrie, one of the great Egyptologists, on a par with the great Breasted, who's also a great, well-known Egyptologist. According to the Book of Jubilees 8 and 12, the lot of Shem, or the Semites, was the middle of the earth. And a great many Semitic people are found today at latitudes of moderate value in and around the equator of the earth. The earth was divided in the days of Peleg, and this is from Genesis 10 and 25, or the Book of Jubilees 8 and 9. When the division of the earth is equated with Babel and the confusion of tongues, it is noteworthy that in the Book of Jubilees, chapter 8, verse 8, about Peleg, it is in the days when he was born that the earth was or is divided. In the Blessed Genealogy, Peleg is born 533 years after 3282 BG, or that's BCE, but in the Blessed Genealogy, before the Common Era, which is the Deluge. So 533 years after the Deluge, which is calculated as 2749 BCE. If you do the math, 3200 minus 500 is 2700, and 82 minus 33 is 49. So 2749 BCE, that's the time of the birth of Peleg. And according to Syncellus, this is according to the Blessed Genealogy, Peleg's born in 2749 BCE. And according to Syncellus in the Old Chronicle of Egypt, there are, quote, 534 years from the flood to the building of the tower, end quote. Compare that to 533, which we just gave as the BG value, almost identical, as well as in the Old Chronicle, there are 2365 years from Egypt's first king to the last king, who's called Nectanebo, and he's dated 342 BCE by modern dating. So with the fact that there are 42 years of building the Tower of Babel after 2749, since the Book of Jubilees told us about Peleg, it was in his days when the earth was divided, that was the building of the tower, when they had the division of the earth, because of the confusion of tongues. If we equate the two and say the division of the earth was caused by, well, we know that after the Tower of Babel too, they divided up the earth, and that's another thing that happened. At least that's what the Book of Jubilees tells us. They divided up the earth into portions after the Tower of Babel was concluded, and after the confusion of tongues took place. That is. So, if we take the time of the birth of Peleg as the time when the tower was begun, just as a marking point, we don't have any other reference, but we have that reference point from the Book of Jubilees, but also from the Bible. It says that it was in his days that the earth was divided. Let's check that scripture, Genesis 10:25. Peleg. The name of the one was Peleg, because in his days the earth was divided. So it is in the Bible. We have no doubt now about that. So, but let's count from 2749 then, which is the birth of Peleg in the genealogy. We have 42 years of building the tower, which is a traditional number that obtained from the ancient sources. We have this number, 42 years. So we're going to subtract that from 2749, and we have 2707, the remainder. And then when we subtract from 2707, okay, so we have the 42 years of building the Tower of Babel after 2749. We have Nimrod or Menes ruling from 2707, from 2707, and using the number given by the old chronicle, 2365, we subtract 2365 from the number 2707. The number we arrive at, what's the word for that? The resulting number is 342. The difference between 2707 and 2365, the number we obtain, that's the word I'm looking for, the number we obtain is 342. That's precisely the difference between 2707 and 2365. Thus, so, and that's the date of Necto-Nebo. The last king of Egypt in 342 BCE. That's the same exact date that we arrive at if we subtract 2365 from 2707. With the 2707 being the date in the genealogy where we are saying that the government began to rule after the Tower of Babel. And that's a rulership that lasted for 2365 years according to the old chronicle. So 2707 minus 2365. And we arrive at 342, which is exactly the right number for the last king of Egypt to complete his own rulership by the modern dating of the Egyptian kings, the way that we date those kings today. Thus, that's the best we can do. We've got complete exact agreement. Thus, the Bible-based Blessed Genealogy agrees remarkably and completely with the old chronicle of Syncellus. 3282 minus 533 minus 42 minus 2365. Where the 533 is our own number in our chronology for the birth of Peleg after the deluge in terms of years. The 42 years is the Tower of Babel and how long they were building it. And then the 2365 is the number of years of kings of Egypt after the Tower of Babel. And the final result is the year of the end of the reign of King Necht-Nebo II in Egypt, which is 342 BCE. That's the end of paragraph 48. We have here a landscape or a picture of the Tower of Babel, painting of the Tower of Babel. Isn't that remarkable, that painting? That is by Tobias Verhecht, who lived from 1561 to 1631 of the Common Era. It's a landscape with the Tower of Babel. Okay, let's begin the Bible study and complete our study for today, little children. Genesis 21, and Jehovah turned his attention to Sarah. We know they were in Gerar. In chapter 20, they just left Gerar. They had the same thing happen to them in Gerar that they had happen in Egypt, with Sarah being taken by the leader of the land, by the ruler of the land, because she was beautiful. He almost took her as a wife, but he didn't in the end. And so in Genesis 21, and Jehovah turned his attention to Sarah, just as he had said, and Jehovah now did to Sarah just as he had spoken, and Sarah became pregnant and then bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the appointed time of which God had spoken to him. Accordingly, Abraham called the name of his son who had been born to him, whom Sarah had born to him, Isaac. And Abraham proceeded to circumcise Isaac his son when 8 days old, just as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when Isaac his son was born to him. Then Sarah said, God has prepared laughter for me. Everyone hearing of it will laugh at me. And she added, who would have uttered to Abraham, Sarah will certainly suckle children, whereas I have given birth to a son in his old age. Now the child kept growing and came to be weaned. I just realized we've got too dim a light here. And Abraham then prepared a big feast on the day of Isaac's being weaned. And Sarah kept noticing the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, poking fun. So she began to say to Abraham, drive out this slave girl and her son, for the son of this slave girl is not going to be an heir with my son, with Isaac. But the thing proved to be very displeasing to Abraham as regards his son. Then God said to Abraham, do not let anything that Sarah keeps saying to you be displeasing to you about the boy and about your slave girl. Listen to her voice, because it is by means of Isaac that what will be called your seed will be. And as for the son of the slave girl, I shall also constitute him a nation, because he is your offspring. So Abraham got up early in the morning and took bread and a skin water bottle and gave it to Hagar, setting it upon her shoulder, and the child, and then dismissed her, and she went her way and wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. Finally, the water became exhausted in the skin bottle, and she threw the child under one of the bushes. Then she went on and sat down by herself about the distance of a bow shot away, because she said, let me not see it when the child dies. So she sat down at a distance and began to raise her voice and weep. At that, God heard the voice of the boy, and God's angel called to Hagar out of the heavens and said to her, what is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, because God has listened to the voice of the boy there where he is. Get up, lift up the boy, and take hold of him with your hand, because I shall constitute him a great nation. Then God opened her eyes so that she caught sight of a well of water, and she went and began to fill the skin bottle with water and to give the boy a drink. And God continued to be with the boy, and he kept growing and dwelling in the wilderness, and he became an archer, and he took up dwelling in the wilderness of Paran. and his mother proceeded to take a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Now, it came about at that time that Abimelech, together with Phicol, the chief of his army, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you are doing. So now swear to me here by God that you will not prove false to me and to my offspring and to my posterity, that according to the loyal love with which I have dealt with you, you will deal with me and with the land in which you have been residing as an alien. So Abraham said, I shall swear. When Abraham criticized Abimelech severely as regards the well of water that the servants of Abimelech had seized by violence, then Abimelech said, I do not know who did this thing, neither did you yourself tell it to me, and I myself have also not heard of it except today. Excuse me. With that, Abraham took sheep and cattle and gave them to Abimelech, and both of them proceeded to conclude a covenant. When Abraham set 7 female lambs of the flock by themselves, Abimelech went on to say to Abraham, what is the meaning here of these 7 female lambs that you have set by themselves? Then he said, you are to accept the 7 female lambs at my hand, that it may serve as a witness for me that I have dug this well. That is why he called that place Beersheba, because there both of them had taken an oath. So they concluded a covenant at Beersheba. After which Abimelech got up together with Phicol, the chief of his army, and they returned to the land of the Philistines. After that, he planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba and called thereupon the name of Jehovah, the indefinitely lasting God. And Abraham extended his residence as an alien in the land of the Philistines many days. That's the end of Genesis 21. So it looks like Abraham is the one who is calling upon the name of Jehovah, the indefinitely lasting God, and who called the name of the place Beersheba. But notice where they said, I shall swear, Abraham said. Jesus said, don't swear, just let your yes mean yes and your no, no. So Christians today, we don't need to swear to make a promise. But back in the days of Abraham, that was a common thing. It was a more common thing than it is now, because Christians don't need to do that at all. We just, if we speak the truth and we always say what we mean, we let our yes mean yes and our no, no, then we don't need to make a promise by swearing to anything. We don't need to make a sworn oath. And we don't need to make these covenants. We can just say something and be true to our word. That's the difference between Christianity and the way that people were before Christianity, for example. That's one of the big differences, or one of the significant differences. So, and we see what happened with Abraham and his other son, Ishmael. How Ishmael was mocking Isaac, and it was very disturbing to Sarah. And also we saw how Abraham drove Hagar away because of that, because Jehovah promised Abraham that his other son Ishmael would also be a great nation, and so he didn't have to worry that he should listen to his wife Sarah, Jehovah said. And so he drove away Hagar and her son, and she thought that they would die in the wilderness of Beersheba. But the angel called out of the heavens to Hagar, and she found a well of water. And Ishmael became an archer eventually, but he kept dwelling in the wilderness of Paran, and he eventually took a wife. His mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. So we see that about Ishmael, and we see about Sarah how she did have a child, and she was quite impressed about that, to the extent that she made these remarks in verses 6 and 7 about bearing a child to Abraham in his old age. And also, of course, Sarah was quite elderly herself. But the interesting thing here too is that remember the covenant of circumcision that Abraham had promised to circumcise everybody who was in his house. So he circumcised Isaac when he was 8 days old. In verse 4, so the covenant of circumcision continued with Abraham, and it was established long before the Mosaic law. This was a covenant that Abraham had with Jehovah regarding circumcision, and the eighth day was the day in which they did that. The eighth day. It says, if we recall Genesis 17 and 12, which we've already read earlier, every male of yours 8 days old must be circumcised. So that was what Abraham, in fact, did do with his new son Isaac. And Isaac was born when Abraham was 100 years old, in verse 5. That's the definition of one generation for Abraham, was 100 years per generation, because that's how old he was when he had his first generation. So there we go. There's our study for today. The genealogy is a remarkable discovery of, and a testament to, the power of the truth and the way the Bible can serve as a beacon of truth to enable us to discover more truth and to sort through all of the detailed minefield of information, but all of the detailed scraps and all the detailed junkyard of ancient facts that's just strewn about, not just buried in the ground, but also in the writings of ancient writers, that the Bible can enable us to sort through all of these ancient writings, all the ancient misconceptions, and all the ancient piles of documentation and artifacts, and can sort through it in a way that enables the conclusion to be the discernment of a true chronology that can enlighten us even further with regard to our history, and can make the truth become historical reality, and that can strengthen our faith far more than just having having a timeless account without any chronology, or having a chronology that's got no evidence other than the written words of men who wrote, you know, the Bible accounts, which are very useful, but they don't have the power to be able to utilize the external evidence in contained in records and in the study of astronomy, for example, in order to date things using the sun and the moon and the other things, the stars, you know, the planets, all the different celestial bodies that can be used in order to ascertain accurate dates, you know, according to what is independent from the word of man in writing things down. So we have an independent verification. The astronomy that we can study, and also not just that, but also the other historical documentation that's all scattered everywhere throughout the world, they can be brought to bear on finding on this idea, on the search for the truth in chronology, and then they can arrive at a true chronology that's consistent with everything. That's the power. But that can make the words of the Bible take on new meaning, because they now have an historical context in which they reside, and they can reside there in such a way as to make them more believable than ever, that because they have a true historical context. It's so powerful. It is so powerful. It's so enlivening and so energizing to realize all the marvelous benefits of having a true chronology. It's just incredible. It's exciting. And I was too excited at times when I was discovering some of these things. I was too excited to contain myself or to be able to continue remaining calm. It was very difficult. There was a lot of joy involved, that's for sure, at the discoveries I was making, the discoveries of the chronology, of the historical nature of the Bible characters. It just came to life so many times and in so many ways, and still does. And I'm sure there are many more things to be discovered. But the essential part of it looks like it's a very good foundation now in the genealogy. And we're going to be studying it, hopefully, more and more, and we'll learn more, I hope. I'm very excited about my study of watches and timekeeping devices now that I'm also, for the first time, doing, now that I've discovered a need for a new watch in my own collection here of watches, of which I really only have a few watches, but in my case. But this is it for today's study. It's March 21st, 2023, 17:55 hours, Ward Green here, saying goodbye for now. I love you very much. Have a wonderful day, and I hope you have enjoyed very much indeed listening and watching this video today. Praise Jehovah. And we always have to mention, if we don't mention Jesus, we're missing something, because if we're not suffering, of course, we may not know Jesus as well. When we suffer, we always know Jesus, because he suffered so much in our behalf. So if we're suffering, it's easier to find Jesus, because he understands our suffering. So bye for now.